Tonight we explore a little bit of California culture with two deep and daring chroniclers of it. S.I. Hayakawa was thrust into history during the San Francisco State student strike of 1968. He went on to become California's senator, and Gerald Haslam's biography of Hayakawa gives an unflinching portrayal of this complex man in his biography, In Thought and Action, The Enigmatic Life of S.I. Hayakawa. Haslam is the author of many books of fiction and nonfiction alike, including Working Man Blues and Straight White Male. He and his co-author, Janice Haslam, join Rosemary Manchester in conversation in just a moment. I'm Suzanne Lang, and you're listening to A Novel Idea. Later in the broadcast, I talk with Jonah Raskin about his latest book, Marijuana Land, Dispatches from an American War. Raskin is the author of Field Days, A Year of Farming, Eating, and Drinking Wine in California, American Scream, Allen Ginsberg's Howl, and the Making of the Beat Generation, and For the Hell of It, The Life and Times of Abby Hoffman, to name just a few. We close out the show with a book review from Barbara Quick, this one of Shandor Mari's Portrait of a Marriage. So stay tuned, we've got lots of conversation ahead. It's A Novel Idea.
Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester, and I have very special guests in the studio tonight. Jerry and Jan Haslam are here. We're going to talk about the book that they have just completed, In Thought and Action, The Enigmatic Life of S.I. Hayakawa. There are still people in California for whom Hayakawa is not a familiar name. So now there's an excellent biography that everyone can learn much more about the life of this very important man. I'm so happy to have the two of you in the studio, Jerry
and
Jan.
Thank you.
Now, how did it come about that you wrote the biography of S.I. Hayakawa?
Well, I had written a book called Working Man Blues about country music in California that did rather well. And in that book, I'd employed three different voices, one of which was a series of biographies, capsule biographies, of what I considered to be the signal performers of given decades. When I finished that book, I was intrigued by biography. It looked like a challenging and interesting way to write. So I thought about whom I might wish to write about. And in doing research, I realized that Hayakawa had not had any biographies written about him. There were a number of pretty good books about the strike at San Francisco State, but nothing about his life. And I'd known him, but I didn't know him intimately. And so I began, I guess you'd say, sniffing around, looking at the material I could find. And when I realized that he was a Canadian, for example, which I hadn't known,
yes,
and that he had been involved with some of the very important writers in Canada when he was in college, and then again at the University of Wisconsin when he was getting his PhD, he was involved with a roster of very important writers. And he thought of himself as a literary person. That came as a great surprise to me because I thought of him as a semanticist. And so I contacted his son and daughter, Alan and Wynn, and talked to them a little bit about the possibility of writing a biography. And they were positive and enthusiastic and gave me total access to the archive with no restrictions, because I said if there were any restrictions, I wouldn't write it. I wanted the dark side and the light side to be shown, because he was a human being like all the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And they agreed. They at no time asked me to change anything. After I started, I a couple times began to think that I was dealing with the tar baby, because I would think I was done, and then another box of documents would show up, some letters, some diaries. Mm-hmm. In fact, it happened while the book was being printed, yet another group of material came, became available, and Jan and I had to add an addendum to the notes, which are online. They're not in the book. Because there was another question that came up, and I thought, boy, I don't know whether I want to write more biographies. This is very demanding.
This is kind of a silly question, but is it easier to write a biography about someone who's no longer living?
I'm certain it is. I think I would have been hesitant, yes, simply because I didn't want to hurt feelings.
His
wife in particular was a very, very nice person. Oh. And there were some things I had to say in the bibliography, not about her,
yes,
but about him and his infidelity, yes, for example,
yes,
that I would have hesitated to
yeah,
say.
Well, you were at San Francisco State while you were studying there. Did you study under Hayakawa?
Yes, when I was a graduate student, I actually did two seminars with him, reading and discussing Science and Sanity by Alfred Korzybski. And I was one of the two or three people, for whatever reason, he picked out and asked to be teaching assistants or editorial assistants. I was an editorial assistant. So that gave him a real boost. And I liked him, but I didn't really know him. I mean, I saw the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Later, I tried to figure out a little more about why he did what he did, which,
yeah,
of course, comes out in the book, without really having a clear understanding until I did a great deal of research.
Mm-hmm. But it does help to have known him. That way you have your own impression of...
Yeah, absolutely. Jan and I were at the Hayakawa house the night he stormed off of the newsroom program on KQED after an exchange, and were there when he got home. And so I know what went on that night, and I've heard all sorts of stories about it, but that I consider inaccurate, given my own experience of, mm-hmm, having been there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just trusted my own memory rather than the variations.
And I think this biography is absolutely superb, and it brings everything together, I think, in your writing, the history and the personal observations of Hayakawa. Although they are personal observations, you keep yourself out of the book.
I do my very best to do that. Uh-huh. I wanted to tell his story because as I learned his story, I was quite taken, quite moved,
yes,
as it were. Uh-huh. And so I didn't want to interpose myself between the readers and the subject.
Right. And let's talk about his story. Mm-hmm. The cover of the book has that iconic photograph of the beginning of the strike,
mm-hmm,
where he climbed up on the sound truck. I don't think his intention was to silence it. He asked the driver.
He asked if he could use the sound truck.
Yes.
He had some sort of announcement he wanted to make, probably telling them that they were assembling illegally. And as he said, he was advised in profane terms that that wasn't possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went into action,
mm-hmm,
and stunned people, including me, when I read about it. I never thought of him. Hayakawa had a very soft voice, and I think I had misjudged him. I didn't realize he had that hard edge. But the more I thought about it later, here's a Japanese-Canadian kid growing up where he was virtually the only Asian-Canadian. He had to be a little tough.
Yes, and impulsive.
Oh, very much so.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think he understood what he was doing, but he did understand immediately thereafter because, mm-hmm, he was an expert on symbolism.
Yes,
and he understood how important that was going to be here for the first time, from his perspective at least. The establishment had fought back against what were seen by him to be irrational demands.
Yes.
And from the students and the street people who were there at the time of the demonstration.
Mm-hmm. I think it must have been very, very difficult for leaders who had always been considered from the left and liberal, and for them to be suddenly in a position where they were threatened from the left. I think that's very difficult for a person in administration.
Yeah, Hayakawa was a noted leftist,
yes,
no question about,
mm-hmm,
it, as were any number of his faculty friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on the basis of my reading of their memoirs, they didn't know how to deal with it at first. It just, as you say, it was a new experience.
It was an impossible situation for the administration.
It seemed to be a no-win situation. The irony is that in the end, in the short term at least, Hayakawa won a great deal,
mm-hmm,
made it to the United States Senate, and I think it was almost directly related, mm-hmm, to his handling of the strike. And yet that made him the enemy of many of his old colleagues.
And he was viewed as the tool of Ronald Reagan.
Absolutely. It was kind of odd because after the strike had been resolved, he was still giving suggestions that seemed to be pro-strike or pro the demands of the strike. Mm-hmm. He wanted ethnic studies emphasized at San Francisco State.
Yes.
He was in favor of special admissions. He went before a congressional committee and talked about it being like people who are starving being locked out of the gates of the city, and you only let one or two in. He said, that's what's happening to the non-white students.
Yes.
We need to open the gates and make special arrangements so that they, too, can come in and share in the educational bounty of California.
Yes.
And I think a lot of his enemies on the left were stunned that he said that, and a lot of them ignored it because it didn't jibe with their preconceived ideas.
Yes. And, of course, the same thing was happening on college campuses all over the country.
All over the country. And I think that the faculty strike at San Francisco State was an attempt to avoid what happened at Kent State. I mean,
Sonoma State too small a school to have an upheaval like that, or what do you
think?
Well,
there were some who tried, as I remember, but we at Sonoma State had actually just prior to their strike begun an ethnic studies program. I think the whole attitude at Sonoma State was at that time so accommodating, it almost seemed silly when people decide they were going to strike. I participated briefly in a sympathy strike, faculty sympathy strike for the faculty at San Francisco State to say that, you know, we think these people are doing what they're doing for the best of reasons, even though it may not be the best of actions.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you mentioned about Hayakawa is the number of different names by which he was called. At one point or another in his life, he was called Samuel, Sammy, Sam, Hack, Don, Doc, S. Ichie, Samuel I, and S. I.
I really think that there was a quest for identity in Hayakawa's life, and I think the names actually reflect that.
Yes.
To me, the funny one is when he was called Sam, that was an invented name, invented by his political handlers because they didn't think that the public would understand what was by then his common casual name, Don. A name given him at the University of Wisconsin because they said he carried himself like an Oxford Don. He had some different personae. It was interesting when you look at him growing up in Western Canada at the University of Manitoba, at McGill University, and finally at the University of Wisconsin. He's a slightly different person in all of those roles. In part because he was very smart, of course.
Yes.
And he was able to absorb the culture around him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think being sort of an isolated member of a minority made him quest for acceptance, to look for ways to develop acceptance from the people around him, often reflecting changes in attire and behavior. By the time he was at the University of Wisconsin, he was a genuine character, according to his fellow students,
mm-hmm.
riding a red motorcycle around town and mm-hmm. developing and editing a literary magazine and where he used all sorts of other names.
Mm-hmm.
H. Hapgood Jr. was one of them. And, you know, the thing about writing biography that I had to learn was that you're dealing here with a real human being. And real human beings are immeasurably changeable. And they can be flexible in this situation and rigid in that. And that's what I found, that this was a complicated man.
Mm-hmm. But he could be his own worst enemy.
Absolutely, he could. He did silly things.
Yes.
There were times when you wondered about his self-discipline.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And really did. I mean, what he said after the first big battle of the strike, where he said it was the most fun he'd had since he'd gone to the carnival when he was 6 years old or 10 years old.
Right.
I mean, that was beneath him.
That was silly, yeah, and it certainly didn't do him any good.
No, it certainly did not.
Well, I love the idea of him playing the harmonica and tap dancing and riding the motorcycle and all that. That doesn't quite fit with what he was trying to accomplish.
Yeah, he developed a series of behaviors that were comforting to him but didn't necessarily comfort his audience.
That's well said, yes.
Mm-hmm. And occasionally people would wonder at length about what it was that was going on within that man.
He was certainly fortunate in the woman that he fell in love with and married, Marge Peters.
Yes.
Amazing. And then, of course, she brought some wealth to the marriage.
Yes, she did.
Which helped a lot because he had a very difficult time finding a position commensurate with his abilities.
Yeah, I think being Japanese in Canada and America during the years he was coming of age was not an advantage. After he finished his PhD at the University of Wisconsin, he interviewed with literally dozens of universities and saw people without PhDs hired, white people without PhDs hired instead of him. Mm-hmm. He was already a distinguished writer at that point in the sense that he was publishing in major journals, and these people who were hired over him had no publications. But it was probably typical Hayakawa of the time that he didn't bother to complain because he knew it would do no good. The 30s, because of what was going on in Japan, were just a rough time to be Japanese-Canadian or Japanese-American.
And academia can be a bit of a jungle. I thought you were extremely diplomatic and tactful in the way you presented how he was resented for his success as a writer. But since you're an academic yourself, you could really explore and explain that difficulty in his life to those of us who don't know that much about academia.
Academia is a world unto itself,
oh, yeah.
Of course. And I've always thought the funniest thing I ever heard about it was that the reason struggles were so vicious in academia is because so little is at stake.
So little is at stake. Let's talk about semantics. I mean, I'd never thought about semantics. Is it a discipline now? Is it being taught?
Well, Don was involved in something called general semantics, which
general
is slightly
semantics.
Different than semantics.
Okay.
And when the word semantics is used, I think scholars think about linguistic semantics, which is a study of meaning. Hayakawa was in the thrall of a man named Alfred Korzybski, who had written a book called Science and Sanity, which deals really with symbolism and things like the physiological responses to symbols. For example, you hear a word, what Hayakawa calls a snarl word, and your blood pressure goes up, and you don't control it. You have no control over it. Those were the kinds of things that he was most interested in. He was also, of course, as was Korzybski, interested in ways of clarifying in order to make communication a little more accessible.
It's like saying a map is not a country.
Yeah, exactly.
And that sort of thing. And that catches the reader's attention. Mm-hmm. And people who read your book are going to find out a lot about general semantics.
Yeah, I think it's important because they can see what it was that enthralled him.
Yes.
It's a strange time in some ways in his life because he was struggling to find an academic position when he encountered general semantics. He was teaching in an extension at the University of Wisconsin. And he was at that time thought to be a very promising poet. A lot of people are surprised to hear that, but he put that behind him, as it were, and jumped with both feet into this field that was not yet acknowledged by academia as being valuable, and as it turned out, never was, or at least never has been.
If Hayakawa were alive today, what do you think his reaction would be to the Occupy movement?
Well, first of all, he'd be 105.
True.
I think that probably you almost have to say which Hayakawa, the Hayakawa who was a founder of Friends of KPFA or the Hayakawa who was Ronald Reagan's appointee. He made a sea change at the end of his life.
Yes.
And I think in a way he had been, my own belief is that he had probably been festering over his rejection at San Francisco State and finally reached a point where it became public. Thurston Womack, who was Don's friend, his neighbor, who used to commute with him, and who, by the way, was a linguist in the faculty at San Francisco State, told me that he had gone to Don's office and asked him to join the faculty union. And Hayakawa had been almost angry at the suggestion and had said no under no circumstances.
And it seemed to me that once he took a position, he had a hard time backing away from it. I was thinking of his very, very unfortunate remarks and his stance about the relocation of the Japanese nationals during the Second World War.
It was one of the things that I found most difficult to understand. And,
yes.
and what I did in the book was simply cite him and let,
yes.
let the reader determine that right. because he wrote a letter, the first letter he wrote to his father in Japan. I should say that his parents and his sisters had moved back to Japan in the 1920s, leaving Don and his brother in Canada for a series of complicated reasons. But so his parents were just outside Hiroshima when the war ended, and suddenly communication became available. His very first letter, in the second paragraph, there's a rather long, I don't know if I'd call it a defense, but an explanation of the internment, which makes it sound reasonable. And from that point on, even though he was not interned, he allowed himself to be employed as a kind of spokesman for Japanese Americans. And I think many readers thought that he had been interned, but he had not. But he couldn't seem to let the subject go. He continued to write op-ed pieces, letters, give speeches. I remember talking to Jim and Jean Houston, mm-hmm. who wrote that wonderful book, Farewell to Manzanar. And Jean said, easy for him to say,
yes,
in reference to Hayakawa.
Exactly.
He wasn't interned.
Exactly.
And that was absolutely right.
Yes.
So I don't understand why he did that. Unless it was simply mm-hmm. an easy way for prominence, for, mm-hmm. for publicity.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that isn't true, because that would be, to me, a diminishing behavior if it was.
But he didn't seem to consider how it would be for the individuals who were actually interned.
No. His aunt and uncle and three cousins were interned.
Yes.
To give Hayakawa credit, he was involved in the relocation to the Midwest of Japanese Americans. That was
kind of
a secondary thing that
yes.
was going on. Now, it only influenced a relatively small number, but he did bring his family out. And shortly after they came to Chicago, both his male cousins became members of the 442nd Regimental Combat
yes.
Team.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Hayakawa mm-hmm. Tried to volunteer for the United States Army, mm-hmm. although he was a Canadian citizen mm-hmm. and was middle-aged.
Mm-hmm.
And then he tried the Canadian mm-hmm. military,
mm-hmm.
and no one wanted him. Well, it seems as though someone with his language training would have been valuable, but
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason, they didn't allow him in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he ever came to grips with it. His aunt was asked her attitude about being interned. His aunt and uncle owned a hotel in Stockton, so they were Californians. And she said, what do you expect? There's a war on. So apparently his family had a different attitude about the whole thing.
Hmm. I know you choose your words carefully. And in the, I like the title of your book, The Enigmatic Life.
I thought I might call it The Enigmatic Lives of S.I. Hayakawa, because there seemed to be so many individuals living within that skin as he went through his rather long life.
Right.
He's very difficult to explain in any simplistic terms, and that's really what I think makes him
yes.
enigmatic.
Yes.
He did many things, did most of them rather well. He was willing to try new things and throw himself into them and become rather competent but not quite an expert in a number of fields. You know, he was well known for his lectures on jazz, for example.
Oh yes, we didn't talk about jazz.
And
right.
People thought of him, and I mean, important musicians thought
yes.
of him as perhaps a leading expert
yes.
during the 1940s and 1950s. By the same token, he of course was a language scholar. He was much involved in poetry. He was very much involved in progressive politics.
Right.
And seemed prominent in all those fields.
Yes.
Until at the end of his life, you know, the downward sweep of health and so on finally forced him to condense, as it were, his energies into things like the English.
What was
US
that all
English.
About? The official English, where did that come from?
It's not clear in my mind whether that was simply an appeal to the public, a political appeal to the public, that because the public much supported that movement. I thought perhaps it was more a matter of a Canadian who had seen what happens when you have two national languages mm-hmm. and the tension has never really been relieved in Canada between French and English. And so he wanted one lingua franca.
Well, good point. Look at Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how it's held them back to have to do everything in two languages. He did have a point, but he wasn't always diplomatic.
No, he used that popularity, the popularity of that cause, to keep himself prominent. What I didn't know was that at the same time he was working for the State Department, he'd been appointed by Secretary of State George Shultz as a representative in Southeast Asia and actually did some very important work there. I knew nothing about that. I don't recall the newspapers carrying stories about that. And that was a side of him. There was a positive side of that time as well, of course. Mm-hmm. He was, as I say, he was an enigmatic man. He was doing things that made it difficult to fully understand his motives and his behaviors.
And when you think of him as a Canadian, Japanese man, an expert on African-American music, and a friend of all the great artists of the time. And at times he was an embarrassment to the African-American community because he was the expert on their music.
It was true. And a lot of people said, you know, what's this fellow doing?
Who's that guy?
Yeah. But he particularly liked jazz, and he gave it a kind of analysis that brought it into a greater academic respectability, mm-hmm. and a lot of folks recognize that. His relationships with other African Americans, for example, his good buddy Langston Hughes. I mean, I was shocked when I realized that Langston Hughes was a frequent house guest. That he Hayakawa and his wife Marge were friends with Mahalia Jackson.
Yes.
They knew Duke Ellington. And they knew not just African-American performers. Frederick March was a house guest, things of that kind. Mm-hmm. This is why I've always thought that the Chicago years were actually more interesting than the San Francisco years.
Yes, there's no question about it. We do tend to focus on the San Francisco years simply because of the strike and the student unrest. And, of course, that catches our attention immediately. But your readers are going to really enjoy the those early years and
You know, he was the first non-black columnist for the Chicago Defender, the leading African-American newspaper in America, or one of the two leading newspapers. And he did such things as write columns attacking black anti-Semitism at a time when no one else was doing that and when no one thought anybody should have the boldness to do it. Mm-hmm. But he thought it was important. Mm-hmm. You know, he says you can't complain about racism if you're practicing anti-Semitism. And that throws the gauntlet down.
People don't want to hear that.
No.
Yes. You know, if Hayakawa had chosen his biographer, he couldn't have done better. I mean, you're the ideal person, you and Jan, to be presenting this material in such a readable way. I mean, it reads like a novel.
Well, Jan gets credit for that because she's the editor. She reads every manuscript, and I take her suggestions seriously. Mm-hmm. And
Smart man. I want to thank you so much for coming in, Jerry and Jan, to talk about this remarkable book about a man that we think we know, Hayakawa, but there's so much more.
I'm happy to hear you say that because that was basically my take. I thought I knew about him, but I didn't. I had to learn a great deal, but it's been rewarding. I learned a great deal. I'm glad it's over, though.
I can imagine so. And we're glad it's over because now it's published and we can read it. So I would encourage all of our listeners, and particularly listeners who draw a blank when they hear the name Hayakawa. So again, the name of the book is In Thought and Action, The Enigmatic Life of S.I. Hayakawa by Gerald and Janice Haslam. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rosemary. Jonah Raskin's life reads like an adventure story. Friends with Doris Lessing, hung out with Abby Hoffman, lived the life of a farm worker for his book Field Days. He's brought us new perspectives on Jack London. And now he presents a travelogue through the geography, the people, the law, and the culture of marijuana here in California. Jonah's parents were part of the culture which naturalized marijuana in their lives. It was not strictly recreational, but was used to ease pain, to rest, and relax. We began our conversation by talking about his parents and their use and cultivation of cannabis.
My parents began to smoke marijuana, as far as I know, in the 1970s when they settled in Sonoma County. My father smoked in a little corncob pipe. This was in the evening. My mother took a couple of puffs and went to sleep. My father would stay up. I later discovered from my father that he was also growing marijuana. In the back 40, they had some land in Occidental, and they were organic farmers. They were doing, you know, what everybody else did. And my father also got cancer, and so he was a very early cancer patient who was using marijuana for his pain and also to stimulate his appetite that chemotherapy had largely done away with.
Was this a big surprise to you when this was daylighted to you that your parents smoked marijuana and grew marijuana?
Well, not really, because my parents were definitely unconventional, and they left Long Island in New York State, and they traveled all around the country, and they had a VW camper, and they lived on communes in Montana, and so the fact that they were growing marijuana in Sonoma County was not really a big shock. I mean, they had also, my mother was a follower of Margaret Sanger and believed in birth control early on, and my father was a lawyer, and he integrated the police force in the small town where we lived. There was no African Americans until he brought a case, and as long as I knew them, they were going against a lot of the American grain, and growing and smoking marijuana was just another example of that.
So when you came into a position where you had to deal with the back 40, did that draw you into the world of marijuana in a different way?
Well, I had smoked marijuana for the first time in 1967, and I had also seen some people growing marijuana in milk cartons, or cut-off milk cartons, and they were tiny plants. So it wasn't until I saw my father's plants that were 7 feet tall and big, bushy plants that I got to appreciate what marijuana actually looked like and learned from him about cultivating marijuana, about harvesting it. So I got my education from him through direct experience, and he died before his crop was ready, and he asked me to harvest the crop. I had moved home to take care of my father when he had cancer, and then I was writing a book, and I smoked marijuana while I was writing the book, and I saw that smoking marijuana helped in the writing of the book. At the publisher, it was published, and the sentences were coherent, and they began and they stopped, and I would say it definitely enhanced memories and imagination and didn't interfere with punctuation and grammar. So I also learned then in the wake of my father's death that marijuana, cannabis, pot, whatever you want to call it, can be and is an aid to creativity, and I have been in and around the marijuana world since the late 1970s, not all the time. I mean, I've had other interests like the Beat Poets and Jack London and Abby Hoffman and Doris Lessing, but I have kept my finger on the pulse of marijuana, and I know probably 100 people in Sonoma County who smoke marijuana regularly, who are professors at Sonoma State, who are doctors, lawyers, accountants, bankers, who own and run restaurants. It's in this funny position where it's concealed. It's not at all like the grape and the wine industry underground. But if you're part of the world, then it is almost like it's out in the open. It's not quite. It's this very strange situation. And it's certainly moving about all of California, and it's being transported and clandestinely and going all kinds of places. And it's also much more visible now than it's ever really been in the past, because we do have dispensaries. And even though the federal government is trying to close them down, all over California. There's way too many dispensaries for them to go after. I mean, there's a lot of, I would say, bigger and more urgent problems. I mean, even the new California State Attorney General, Kamala Harris, believes that the federal government has its priorities all messed up. If they're closing down dispensaries, I mean, there's murders and domestic violence and environmental pollution, you know, a host of ills.
Jonah, why do you think that marijuana is something that is in the mainstream, yet it's still kind of an underground, above-ground dichotomy?
Yes. Well, it's in this strange place because it's illegal by federal law. Everything about marijuana, growing it, transporting it, smoking it, possessing it, is illegal by federal law, whereas state law makes provision for medical marijuana. So state law says yes and federal law says no. And yes, I would say there's a lot of misperceptions about marijuana. Probably the most influential marijuana movie that was made in the last 30 years was like Up in Smoke by Cheech and Chong. And they popularized this sort of image of the stoners who are goofy and don't really know what they're doing. And it's a giggly kind of comedy. And so sort of marijuana and humor have gone together. And I think I was trying to say earlier when I was talking about accountants and lawyers and doctors who smoke it, that it's not just this sort of old stereotype of the stoner. It's a lot of different people. It's people who have HIV and AIDS, and it's really essential for their well-being. It's part of the culture of California teenagers. It's a rite of passage. I would say that most of the students in my classes, 17 and 18-year-olds, have some experience with marijuana. Some of them feel very strongly about it, that it should be legalized. I know some people who are adamantly against it, and yet they do, and they have told me, yes, that they feel like it really enhances the way food tastes. And so there's just a whole range of benefits. I don't agree with people who say that marijuana or cannabis or hemp will save the world. I mean, I think that there are benefits about hemp. I mean, it's grown in Canada, in Russia, in China. It can be used for paper and fabrics and all kinds of products. But I don't think I don't see it as like a miracle drug.
Or a miracle plant that will replace other things like sustainable forestry or something like that.
Yes, yeah. Right. So I think that because there's the misperceptions and the stereotypes and the war against it, that people who are in favor of it sometimes get pushed into this sort of corner where they also kind of make extravagant statements that don't hold that much water for me, like hemp will save the world. I don't think there's any one single thing that will save the world, really.
Yet it may actually contribute to a strong economy. And in areas like the area you talk about in your book in Northern California, where there is a changing economy and a lot of people were put out of work as mills close down and as forestry in California changes. And it seems that there is a potential that by regulating its cultivation, that the potential exists for it to be yet another regulated thing, but also where you don't have environmental impacts from the illegal cultivation of marijuana, which does happen. And I think we've seen that in Sonoma and Mendocino County happening. So,
yes. Well, when you make marijuana illegal, the government creates like the state of lawlessness where it's largely unregulated. There's a black market and it's underground. So if you legalize it, it means that there's more government regulation. There's more rules. Well, like, for example, there need to be sort of rules that are enforced about how marijuana is cultivated, that you're not using toxic pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers, and that people are really respecting the environment and not polluting it. I mean, there's people who are outlaw guerrilla growers in national forests who really are trashing the environment, and there's environmental groups that go in and clean up, you know, tons of garbage. So it's to have it regulated and have it taxed and the quality of it, you know, supervised. I would say that it can contribute to the well-being of the economy and here in the North Coast, Sonoma County, and all of California. That, I mean, hemp can also be, you know, a source of fuel. And if we don't want to be dependent on foreign oil, you know, why not grow hemp and use that? And hemp grew wild in the North American continent. It was already growing wild when the first colonists arrived and settled here, and they were overjoyed to find the hemp plant here, which they used for all kinds of things, which the Native Americans were using. Thomas Paine, the great American patriot, said, as long as we have hemp, we're not going to be dependent on any foreign country. We're going to have to make our own rope, which is essential for a fleet. And so it has been for a long time. It was as American as cherry pie and mom and the flag. And it's only really since 1937, that when the federal government made it illegal, that it has been driven into the underground. I mean, that's not that long a time from 1937. I mean, from when the Pilgrims arrived in 1620, you know, for the next 200 years, you could go to a doctor, you could get a prescription for cannabis, you could go to a pharmacy and you could get it filled. And there were people who were using it for back pain and headaches and cramps and all kinds of things. So, yeah, there's a long, rich history. The history that we as a country have not learned from is the history of the prohibition of alcohol, which was a failure and led to organized crime and led to violence. It lasted much shorter period of time than the prohibition of marijuana. But the both prohibitions have been a failure in terms of how the law affects the lives of ordinary people, of arresting them, sending them to jail, of getting them tangled up in the courts. I mean, except for the fact that they smoke marijuana, these are people who are otherwise law-abiding citizens. They pay their taxes, they vote, they have families, they go to work, they put on their pants in the morning and get in their car and follow the traffic rules and regulations, right? So they're all out there.
I want to get back to the book. That is, in some ways, it's like a travelogue or a ride along, and you were riding along and meeting people along the way and meeting with law enforcement people and people cultivating, and interwoven with your own reflections, and it provides a lot of good information and great pictures, too. I wanted to say it's a lovely book. Tell us a little bit about the publication of the book.
So it's published by High Times. They provided the photographs. I mean, High Times is probably the longest running publication of the marijuana industry and been around since the 1970s. And there is somebody whose job it is at High Times to read every manuscript before it's published and to make a list of negative or critical things about marijuana, because for the most part, they don't want to say critical or negative things about marijuana. And the person who has this job made this really long list. He said, you know, Jonah points out that some of the growers are polluting the environment, some of them are greedy. And I mean, I would say that I have just about every point of view about marijuana. It's not just rah-rah marijuana. There's real genuine criticism, I think, about what's going on. So the owner of High Times said, well, in this book, we're not going to abide by our old rules. This book does make criticisms, and we're going to go with that, and it's out there. So I also think that shows a kind of new maturity on the part of the marijuana industry, that it doesn't just have to beat its chest and tell good stories, that it can reveal some of the really serious flaws. So, Yeah, I appreciate your comments about the book. I see it as, in a lot of ways, it's an adventure story. It is gonzo journalism in the style of Hunter S. Thompson, who like popularized it in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And a friend of mine describes gonzo journalism as the journalism where you put the reader in the passenger seat with you, and the passenger is riding along. And so that's definitely what I've tried to do, to have readers going on the road, going to the sheriff's department with me, going up in the mountains and meeting growers and talking to doctors and dispensary owners. So yeah, there's a lot of history in the book. I mean, going back to the Sufis in Cairo who were growing it and were persecuted and prosecuted by the Egyptian authorities like hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and the Marijuana Tax Act. And
that's what is constantly, I think, confounding, Jonah, to many of us, is that this is a plant that has been around for a long time, and people have been engaging with it throughout the history of humanity, yet it still seems to insult so many people.
I mean, there is the human tragedy of it that every year in the United States, there are more than 800,000 marijuana arrests. And since 1970, there's been over 20 million arrests. And most of this is for small amounts, like 3 or 4 grams. And it's also people who are arrested are a lot like black and Latino teenagers. And
if we think then about the economy of that in a state of California, where there's a whole prison industry built around this, and the cost of that versus regulation and change of how we approach this might actually benefit communities in different ways.
Right. Well, it does keep law enforcement people in their jobs and working and getting salaries. It does keep prisons like full up of people. Got to house these people arrested. It keeps the courts like really clogged up with cases and keeps prosecutors busy. And there's a whole, the criminal defense law, people, lawyers who are defending people. I mean, we have a number of lawyers in Sonoma County who all they do is marijuana defense, and they're busy all the time. There's no end of cases. So, it's a fascinating story. The students in my class have asked me, I've talked on campus. I also think it's a sign of the times have changed that the program for first-year students invited me to talk about marijuana to freshmen, to 17 and 18-year-olds. And they came, and they're very knowledgeable about it. They said, well, when do you think it's going to be legalized? And they got sad, disappointed looks on their faces when I said, it's not going to be in my lifetime. I don't see that happening. I mean, I'm on the cusp of 70. I mean, maybe if I live till 90, maybe. We are in this long, long transitional period, and it's going to go on being a battleground. One of the things, let me add this is sort of different than I think we've been talking about, is that I'm really fascinated with the stories that people tell. I mean, there's a whole oral culture connected with marijuana because a lot of it is not written about. And so when you get marijuana growers and smokers and traffickers together, they're telling great stories. And so I've included as many of the great stories that I could in the book. And
it very much has a feeling of touring through a beautiful part of our state and meeting people who maybe if we were just driving through, we'd see them anyway. But you stop and ask them questions and
yes,
bring them out.
Yeah. I had great fun like being out there and traveling around and going places and talking to people. And yeah, I had great fun like sitting and writing about it. And I just thoroughly enjoyed the whole process of it. And it's also been fun to go out and to You know, to talk about marijuana in bookstores, I've been in a lot of bookstores, and people, like when I was in Sebastopol or Copperfields, like people came up afterwards and told me their stories. There was a woman who came up and said, my name in the marijuana world is Kenna Bitch. She works a few months of the year as a trimmer, you know, cutting away the outer leaves from the marijuana plant, and makes enough money, really, to live sort of the whole rest of the year. I mean, it's just become very specialized and sort of very lucrative, and it is going all around the country. There are people who are either brave enough or foolhardy enough to transport it from around here to Maryland and Kentucky or to Florida, where it's just you can get way more money for it than it would be selling for here. And
it's amazing that I was just visiting friends up around Nevada City, and they have an organic farm there, and they said they do not grow marijuana, but everybody else in their little valley does. And up in Butte County, I know that it seems that there might be, would we call them appellations or variances in the parts of the state that people are cultivating marijuana?
Yes, well, the counties of Humboldt, Lake, Mendocino, Trinity are known as the Emerald Triangle. And so there are people who want to trademark and copyright Emerald Triangle, because it's actually a term that's known in here and in Europe. If you go to Amsterdam, you can get Emerald Triangle marijuana, you know, pot from Humboldt County.
And didn't somebody in your book actually talk about maybe envisioning it being kind of like going to the wine country, that that could be an aspect of what they have to offer up there?
Right. Yes, I do know some people in New York City and Manhattan who have lots of money at their disposal and wanted to have a marijuana tasting room in Sonoma County, where people could come in and park and see marijuana growing and smoke some of it and have a gourmet meal and learn about pot. And they were going pretty strong about this until the recent raids and by the federal government and the get tough policy by the federal government. So they have pulled back. I would say I don't know anybody who stopped growing or smoking because of the federal policy, but it has had a kind of chilling effect on people who would have invested and taken it to the next level. And it's a story that is not going to go away anytime soon. There's going to be additional chapters, and I'm continuing to follow it and to monitor it. And it's been great fun to do it.
Well, I think the book is a good read for those who are more aware and involved in marijuana as a substance or as a lifestyle choice. But it also, I think, for those of us who live in Northern California, this is a big part of life in Northern California that mm-hmm. isn't really talked about in such a straightforward and humanizing way. And so I want to encourage readers to pick it up. Marijuana Land, Dispatches from an American War.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jonah.
You're listening to A Novel Idea. Finally, on tonight's broadcast, a book review from novelist and screenwriter Barbara Quick.
The story is one we hear again and again. The work of a great artist is sucked down by the waves of fashion and thick-headedness into utter obscurity. The artist, so hugely wronged, dies in despair and, more likely than not, poverty. And then some magic, slow-working yeast begins to bubble, and the artist's work, or some part of it, becomes buoyant enough to rise into the light again. Belatedly, the work is recognized for its greatness, and the world pays homage to the dead genius who gave us the gift of something eternal. At the turn of this century, it happened to a Hungarian writer named Sándor Márai. His novel, Embers, first published in Hungary in 1942, was translated into English in 2000 and greeted by the world as a masterpiece of fiction. The praise and fanfare came 11 years after the author had shot himself in the head following a long life of obscurity and exile in San Diego. Embers is one of the most perfect novels I have ever read. If you haven't read it yet, I envy you. The book is short, brilliant, poignant, and certainly perfect for any reading group that values literary excellence. Knopf has just brought out the fifth of Márai's novels to be translated into English. Portraits of a Marriage tells the story of one man's two marriages from four different points of view. With all these first-person narrators and weighing in at 372 pages, the novel is much less neat and perfect than Embers. But it's a treasure chest nonetheless, filled with something we rarely see in the wonderfully written, quirky, award-winning novels that are being hailed today. Wisdom. Sándor Márai's aperçu about humanity are scattered throughout the narrative like gemstones. Consider this one observation. Culture is what happens when a person or a people overflow with some great joy. I don't know about you, but I rarely read any newly published work that makes me look up from the page and think. Even while the story urges me to keep reading, to see how it ends, and where the author's sympathies truly lie. The town where Márai was born isn't even part of Hungary anymore. This author's exile was so thorough that even his birthplace became someone else's country. There's little we can do to right the wrongs visited on this literary master apart from reading his words. They, at least, live on. This is Barbara Quick for A Novel Idea.
Thank all of you for joining us.
You can find our podcasts online at www.krcb.org. I'm Suzanne Lang.
And I'm Rosemary Manchester. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.